Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in the life of David today. We're going to begin 2 Samuel chapter 5 and 7. The first few verses of chapter 5 tell us something about the beginning of David's reign. And then chapter 7 tells us the tremendous promise that God makes to David because David wanted to build him a house. Let's look at chapter 5 first, if we could. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron. Now, when it says all the tribes, if you'll look at 1 Chronicles 12, verses 23 through 40, you'll see a lot more detail about the festival occasion, the large number of people who came. Now, Hebron. You'll notice from the map here that Hebron is far to the south. It wasn't an appropriate headquarters for a long period because it was too far south. And so David is going to move the headquarters after about 7 years to Jerusalem. And we'll get to that in just a minute in the text. Notice where it says, "And said, Behold, we are bone of your bone and flesh of your flesh." Now there are three reasons given why these tribal leaders said that David ought to be king. The first one is found there, "You are one of us, you're one of our kinsmen." Now really, these qualifications go back to Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20, where it had to be one of their own countrymen, and it had to be someone God chooses, and we'll see that. The second one is in verse 2. "You are the one who led Israel out and in." Now that goes back to the time of Saul. As you know, David, after killing Goliath, became Saul's armor-bearer, and then became his trusted military commander. And so the military victories of the Philistines were David's victories, and that's what we have here in this account. Now, so David was a well-seasoned, effective, successful military man. Now, third is also in verse 2 where it says, "And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be a ruler over Israel." Now, here we have God's choice involved. If you'll look back in 1 Samuel 16:13, you'll see where David was anointed by Samuel. And that became a very important aspect of this whole history of God working with Israel. In that same period, Saul is rejected, and David is affirmed and blessed and anointed. Now, the word Lord there, whenever the term Lord appears with all caps, it refers to the covenant name for God, Yahweh, which is the Hebrew verb to be. You might want to see Exodus 3:14. The patriarchs called God El Shaddai, God Almighty. But Moses was the beginning of God revealing his name, Yahweh. That's the covenant name for God, always used in connection with Israel. Now, when it says shepherd my people, of course, you know the 23rd Psalm, how beautiful it is about how God is shepherd. And the king is a physical, earthly representative of God. Now, notice you will where it says, "and be ruler over Israel." At this part, Israel is still a collective name for all of the Jewish people. Verse 3, "So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron." Now, all the elders, if you remember back in the wilderness wandering period, Moses brought the elders together and gave them some responsibility in their own tribal groups for judging the people and handling small disputes. These would be the older, respected leaders of the individual tribes. So the leaders came to David. Now, there's a little context here about chapters 3 and 4. As you know, Saul's military commander was killed in a treacherous way, and then Saul's son was killed in a very treacherous way, and David seems, and throughout this context, to be disassociating himself from this violence against Saul's family and the servants. And I think the elders recognized that and went ahead and asked him to be king, even with so much violence connected with this. Now, "And King David made a covenant with them before the Lord at Hebron, and they anointed David king over Israel." Now, they anointed. Let's go back just for a minute. In 1 Samuel 16:13, Samuel anoints David king in a secret ceremony. Now, if we'll look at 2 Samuel 2:4, David is anointed king over Judah only. And now he's anointed king over all of the people of God. Now, Abithair and Zadok the priest were with David, and they're the ones that would do this. Now, the word anointing, the term means Messiah. And that's the basic root meaning, Messiah. Now, anointed means God's special provision that's physically represented in the placing of olive oil on people's head. John Calvin got his designations for Jesus Christ by the people in the Old Testament who were anointed: prophets, priests, and kings. And that's how he dealt with Christ, as prophet, as priest, as king. And I think there's some real beauty there. So here we have the king of Israel anointed as God's special representative in a unique, empowered way. And that's the idea here. Notice it says, David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. And the term 40 in the Bible is usually a long period of undesignated time, but we're real close to it being pretty literal. Maybe 39, maybe 41, but real close in there here. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah for 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. Now, we're not exactly sure how Ith-Bosheth's two-year reign affects that 7 years in Hebron. But now Jerusalem. There is no J in Hebrew. It's a Y. Yeru-Salem. Yeru. What does that mean? Well, we're not sure, but many think the derivation is Yahweh, or God, will see to it. Now, that is speaking about the ram on Mount Moriah when Abraham was offering Isaac. Now, Salem, remember that back in the early parts of Genesis, I believe it's Genesis 14, 18, is the city that Melchizedek comes from. Now, later, it's taken over by Canaanites, and it's known as Jebus. That's where we get the Jebusites. Now, Jerusalem is a very well-fortified city. On three sides, there's a very deep valley. And on one side only would it have to be real fortifications to keep the city from being impregnable. Now, we learn back from the book of Judges and Joshua, Joshua 11:3 and Judges 1:8, that although Joshua captured it and burned it, they did not possess it. Now, there's been much discussion because in Judges 1:21 and Joshua 15:63, it says it was not taken to the time of David. Now, I really believe there are two cities. There is one city up on Mount Zion that was the Jebusite fortress. And there was another lower city, probably somewhere in the area of Mount Moriah, that probably that's the one that fell, but the upper fortress probably did not fall until the time of David. And verses 6 and following describe how David made Jebus, which he changed to Jerusalem, the capital. And there we have it. I'm going to show you a couple of slides of the beauty of Jerusalem. You can see some of the physical precipice on which the city is built. Okay, now let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 7. And we're doing verses 1 through 17. Now, a beautiful parallel to this would be 1 Chronicles 17, and I hope you'll read that. Now, it came about when the king lived in his house, and the Lord had given him rest on every side from all his enemies. Now, here is the theological understanding of history. God is in the business of taking care of his nation and his people. Notice where it says in verse 2, the king said to Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in a house of cedar." Now, this house of cedar, this whole chapter is on a play on words. Notice the word house in verse 2, the word house in verse 5. Notice the word house in verse 11 and in verse 13. David wants to build God a house, really a temple. God says, "No, David, but you had a good thought there, boy. I'm going to build you a house. I'm going to build you a dynasty, and there'll always be someone to sit on your throne." Now, that's the play on word. The house is God's temple, the house as David's descendants. Now, David lived in a beautiful home. It had been created by Tyre, Hiram, king of Tyre. It was material from his area, cedars of Lebanon, beautiful things. And so David lived in a marvelous palace. And Nathan said to the king, "Go and do all that is in your mind, for the Lord is with you." Now, Nathan was a great man of God. But Nathan, as so many times all of us do, he spoke before he prayed. So he said, oh, that sounds good, David. Well, that's a great idea. Do it. But that night God said, say, Nathan, don't you think you ought to ask me about this? I don't think it's a good idea. Now we learn from 1 Chronicles 22:8 and 28:3 that the reason that God did not want David to build him a house is because David was a man of war and bloodshed. Now in the text here, the reason is given, I haven't asked you to build me a house all the days that I brought this people up from Egypt. I've never asked for a house. Here it's kind of like, I didn't ask you, don't do it. In the other passages, it's you're just too much of a man of war, too much blood on your hands. Now notice where it says, go and say to my servant David. Now my servant is an honorific title. That was the name for Moses after Joshua's death. It was the name of Joshua. And here David is called that. Now I believe this may be the background in the New Testament for Paul and many of the apostles being called a servant of the Lord. Now this may be the background. It's either in the New Testament an honorific title like here, or it's a contradistinction from Jesus as master and them as slaves. But this is a very good background, probably. Notice as I did, but I have dwelt in a house, not dwelt in a house, since the day I brought up the sons of Israel from Egypt, even to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent, even a tabernacle. I've got two different shots. I want to show you a tabernacle. You can see this beautiful picture of a valley with the hills in the background. The beautiful tabernacle, surrounded by the colorful tents of the people of Israel. Notice if you would then where it says, wherever I have gone with all the sons of Israel, I did not speak a word with one of the tribes of Israel, which I commanded to shepherd my people. Now it says, wherever I have gone. Y'all see Leviticus 26, 11 and 12. Basically what we have here is God saying, I've walked with you, I've talked with you, I've been with you. And that's what he's saying here. Solomon repeats this very same thing in 1 Kings 8, 16 and following, in his prayer of dedication. And so it's a very common thing that's repeated over and over. Notice when it says, one of the tribes which I've commanded to shepherd. Now, what does that mean? Well, I think here we have several. Moses was the tribe of Levi. Joshua was the tribe of Ephraim. Saul was the tribe of Benjamin. David's the tribe of Judah. So you see how there are different leaders from different tribes. And I think that's what it's referring to. Now, in verse 8. Now, therefore, thus you shall say to my servant David, thus says the Lord of hosts. Now, the word here for Lord of hosts, you ever sing Martin Luther's great hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God? A little phrase that says, Lord Sabbath, his name, from age to age the same. Well, now, Sabbath is not Sabbath, like Saturday, but Sabbath means the commander of the armies of heaven, the captain of hosts, and that's what it's used here. Now, there are four things mentioned here to describe God's initiative and God's grace in calling David and making him king. The first one is in verse 8. I took you from the pasture. Here's a beautiful picture of David being a shepherd. God's called a shepherd. Jesus is called a shepherd in John 10. And you catch the background there. Verse 9. I have been with you ever since you have gone and have cut off all your enemies from before you. God says, I've been the one that's won your battles. I've been with you militarily. Then in verse 9, I will make you a great name. That's exactly the same promise he made to Abraham in the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 15 through 22. And then the fourth one is, I will appoint you a place for my people Israel. And here's the promise of God taking the initiative and in grace giving the promised land. Verse 11 mentions, even from the day that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and that's, you know that in the Bible as the book of Judges, and I will give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord also declares to you that the Lord will make a house for you. Now this covenant with David about making his descendants forever on the throne is found in Psalms 89, and you ought to read that. It's a beautiful passage where verse after verse, it's reaffirmed the covenant with David and how God's going to bless him and be with him and multiply him and on. Now, verse 12. When your days are complete and you lie down with your fathers, there is a family solidarity even in death. Isn't that something? You see, the Jews believed that the dead went to Sheol and they were just a pale shadow of what they really were physically, but they were conscious. They knew people. And so to bury the fathers together was the family. And I will raise up your descendants after you, who will come from you, and I will establish his kingdom. Now, you might want to see a couple of passages that talk about God doing this. Isaiah 11, verses 1 and following, and Jeremiah 23, verses 1 and following. Okay? And he shall build a house for my name. Now, is this talking about Solomon or about Jesus? Well, I think it's talking historically about Solomon, but the allusions here go far beyond Solomon to Jesus Christ when it says, I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. That goes far beyond Solomon, I want to tell you. And so here we have a messianic reference. Now, I want to stop for a moment and say to you, I don't think we can fully understand the theological disaster of the Babylonian exile. This promise said that you'll never lack a man, David, to sit on your throne. But we know from history that because that the people of God continued to break God's covenant, that there came a time in their life when God left them and they were taken into Babylon. Oh, friends, they wonder, does God still love us? Does God still care? Is there any hope? Will there ever be a Davidic king? The Davidic king was taken in chains to Babylon and never returned. Now, some of his relatives did, Zerubbabel under Ezra and Nehemiah that period. But here it seemed like that all of God's promises had come uncertain. And they really wondered, is there any hope? Will God ever reestablish? And I think that's what we see here. Now, notice if you would where it mentions then, in verse 14. And I will be a father to him. Now, I want to say a word about the relationships in the Bible. All of the metaphors to describe the relationship between God and man are very intimate family relationships. God is called a father, Israel a son. God is called a husband, Israel a wife, like the book of Hosea. God is called the kinsman redeemer, or the kinsman advocate, or avenger, and we're in Israel the close kin. Now, the reason for that is God is not father because of sexual generation. God is not father in chronological sequence to Jesus. God is father in the sense of intimate personal relationship. I think that's why Jesus used this title so much, to show us what God is really like. Now, notice if you will where it says, and he will be a son to me. Now, you ought to see Psalms chapter 2, verse 7. Now, there is several people who are described as a son. We'd like to show you a graphic at this time where you can see that. You notice when it's plural, it always refers to the angels, the Benim Elohim. Well, at one time it's plural and not angels, but most of the time it is. When it's singular, it's used of the nation as a whole. In Hosea, it says, out of Egypt I brought my son, speaking of the nation. Then it speaks of the king, as it does here in 2 Samuel 7. And finally, of the Messiah. I guess the classical passage would be Daniel 7:13. But Jesus used the term Son of Man, Son of God, you know, for him. So you can see how the word Son is used of the Messiah. Now, notice, if you will, where it says, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And you ought to see verse 16 where that same term is used. Now, that term forever is a very interesting term. It's most of the time it's the word olam in Hebrew. And it must be interpreted in light of the context in which you find it. It says the sacrificial system will be forever. It says the Davidic king will be forever. We realize that there was a break in the Davidic king and the sacrificial system has passed away. There is no temple now. So this word can mean temporary, long period, and then really forever. And it's hard to know exactly which it is. I want to give you a few references, if I could, about forever. And they're going to be crawled across your screen, too. Psalms 89, 29, 36, and 37. Psalms 132, verse 11. And Jeremiah 33, verses 17 and 21 are some uses of the term forever. Now, when it says, when he commits iniquity, I will correct him with the rod of men and with the strokes of the son of men. Now, obviously, this cannot refer to the Messiah. If verse 13 does refer to Jesus, then verse 14 has to refer to Solomon. Now, what the Old Testament usually does is take a historical occasion and use it to foreshadow the future promises of God. And that's what I think we have here. Now, the correcting rod here is the idea of Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 and following. Notice verse 15. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him. Now, this word loving kindness is the Hebrew verb, as Yahweh is the Hebrew noun. It's usually translated mercy in King James, loving kindness in New American Standard. I think it is analogous to the New Testament term agape. It means God's covenant loyalty. God, no strings attached love. That God's love pours out without looking at the nature or the response of the recipients. Now, I think that's very true. But as there's no strings attached in God's love initially, God's love cost everything. It is the pearl of great price. And so I think it's a paradox here. Notice it says, "And as I took it away from Saul..." Now I want to go back and look at Saul quickly. Saul had such great potential, and I think he was a great fella. But boy, he had some personality problems, and they finally surfaced, and it devastated him. He was so paranoid and threatened, and he was a tall, handsome man, and yet he was always so threatened by people. Now, his problems began back in 1 Samuel 13, verses 12 and 13, where he himself offered a sacrifice without waiting for Samuel. And boy, that was the beginning of his rebellion. His second act of rebellion is found in 1 Samuel 15, 20 through 23, when he was supposed to kill all of the people of Agag, but he didn't kill Agag, and he didn't kill some of the cattle. And Samuel said, "What is this lowing that I hear in my ears?" And Saul tried to make excuses, but again, he disobeyed. So in chapter 16, verse 14, it says, "The Holy Spirit left Saul, and the evil spirit of the Lord came upon Saul." And so from this part on, there's a terrible personality disruption in Saul. Verse 16, "And your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever." Do you catch the play on house again? House as being God's temple, and here house as being a dynasty of divinic kings. "And your throne shall be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David." Now, Nathan was one of those unique representatives of God who had the opportunity to work with a man of faith as a king. And still Nathan had to confront David in some very hard areas later on. Bathsheba, Uriah, the cover-up. So Nathan was truly a man of God. I think it's helpful to me as a pastor to know that Nathan got so exuberant over David building a temple that he forgot to ask God about it. Sometimes things done with the best motives are just not God's will. And God had to say, "Look, Nathan, you're going to have to go back now and tell David what I want him to know, not what you want him to know." We need to hear that sometimes, because I think we speak our messages out of the best intentions. And we look at the circumstance, this would be a great idea, let's do this for God. But I think a biblical faith is, we don't do things for God. We are informed by God about what he wants us to do for him. We need to be careful about running before God. Now, David had a pretty good idea here, and God's going to fulfill it in the life of his son. But it just was not the time and the place. And the prophet had to be told that too. This chapter, I think, sets the stage for the great, great promises in the life of Christ. Joseph is of the line of David. We're not sure if Mary was or not. There's two genealogies, apparently. One in Luke, which seems to be Mary's, and one in Matthew, which seems to be Joseph's. Now, I know it sounds ridiculous to us that Joseph's lineage would be the what we go by with Jesus' life when Joseph wasn't the daddy. But for a Jewish society, the lineage legally came through the daddy. And so even though Joseph was not Jesus' father, the lineage came through him. And that sounds so funny to us, but that's the Jewishness of this book. And so him, Jesus being divinic is very, very important. And it comes from this passage. So we have the great hope now of the Messiah coming out of the seed of David. Now, if you go back to Genesis 49:10, it talks about Messiah as Shiloh coming out of Judah. And so here we have and of course David was in the line of Judah. And here we have the divinic seed coming from the tribe of Judah, the line of the tribe of Judah, Shiloh, the scepter from the line of Judah. And here we have David's children, the line of Jesse in Isaiah, the shoot from the stump of Jesse, which, of course, is David's father. This promise that the Messiah would be physically of the tribe of David. I don't think you and I can imagine how much it hurt those Jews for the divinic king to be taken in chains. They just thought God wouldn't do it. But you know, sometimes God has to say to us, ritual's not enough. You've got to love me. You see, basically, the emphasis of the Bible is not on outward ritual or liturgy, but on a personal relationship with God. When the relationship is in place, then everything else can be meaningful and have great symbol and great truth. But if the personal relationship is not there, the rest is a mockery. And really, the rest becomes a barrier to God. It becomes our own self-righteousness, which is so seen in the nation of Israel after David and Solomon. Well, I have really enjoyed being with you, and I hope that you'll pray for me as I study, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.